Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode in the New Books and Gender Studies podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Kyle McMillan. And today I have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Megan Condis and her talking about her new book, Gaming Masculinity: Trolls, Fake Geeks, and the Gendered Battle for Online Culture. Professor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing well also. I just wanted to start out by going a little bit into your background in terms of your academic career, but also what led you to write about masculinity and gaming?
So in terms of my academic career, right now I teach at Texas Tech University in communication studies. And before that, I was at Stephen F. Austin State University in the English department, and I studied at the University of Illinois in the English department. So I've got kind of a strange trajectory bouncing between departments and colleges. And partly that's because my project is kind of resting at the space that lives in between like literature or writing studies and communication studies. And I'm lucky because I've had mentors who have been okay with me doing that kind of interdisciplinary bouncing back and forth between departments. In terms of the book, how I came to be interested in gaming and masculinity, I've been a gamer, which that term is fraught, I guess, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But I've thought of myself as a gamer since I was very young. My dad, when I was growing up, was the manager of a pizza parlor that had arcade machines in the lobby. And so I would play out there, and we had a Nintendo Entertainment System when I was young. And I remember being a young girl in that culture, I always felt a duty, I guess, to perform a sort of tomboyishness in order to get along. And I think what got me really interested when I was an undergrad and I was first learning about like gender studies, women's studies, was this idea that, you know, as whatever kind of body you have or whatever kind of identity you have, you can kind of adopt masculine or feminine traits when you enter into particular spaces, or maybe I should say you are expected to do that. And so I got really interested in this idea that online gaming in particular was restrictive in the sense that it kind of required people to adopt a more masculine presentation, whether they were men or whether they were women, when they're entering into these gaming spaces. But then also, you know, okay, so that's a restriction on who is allowed to play, who is allowed to be a gamer, but it also might be a place of conflict where maybe new kinds of alliances or new kinds of personal presentations or identities can be formed.
Yeah, and I also want to say part of the reason why I initially picked up your book at that popular culture conference is because I also enjoy gaming, and I thought this was a really interesting look into this culture. And part of, in terms of recent events, part of that culture and how you begin your book and end your book, actually, is with the Gamergate scandal, right? So for those that aren't familiar with that, could you just go over what was that and why was that important to understand why online gaming culture is gendered?
Yeah. Okay, that's a hard one. Okay, so it's hard to describe because there's so many different narratives that are floating around out there about it. And that's kind of where it gains its power. So Gamergate started in a very small venue. It was a game developer named Zoe Quinn, and she had a jilted ex-boyfriend who was real mad about their breakup and wrote this post about how she's real mean and bad. And he circulated around in these games forums and on Reddit and places like this. And as the post sort of became viral and got picked up and read in different places, it got kind of taken up as an excuse to interrogate this female game developer's life and harass her and bother her and dox her and send her threats on Twitter and, you know, all the horrible trollish behavior that we know and love on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And as this movement sort of gained momentum, there were people in the gaming community that saw that this was a group of people who felt angry and felt kind of betrayed by women in general, and especially by women in gaming spaces, kind of felt like women were invading their kind of safe spaces. And so these people directed that energy and said, this sounds very conspiracy theory-like, I guess, but you can find there are people who have documented this online where you can go into their, they call them raid channels, where people would plan this out and say, here's the next person we're going to harass online because she's a game developer or a feminist game critic and we don't like her. There are these people within that group who said, okay, we're going to kind of harness this energy and this anger, and we're going to try to direct it at women and people of color and queer people in gaming culture. And one of the things that I talk about in my book is that I think that movement, Gamergate, I don't want to say this, it was both kind of a precursor to the alt-right in general, or maybe an arm of the alt-right as it exists online. And also it was a kind of a recruiting ground that a lot of anti-feminists and white supremacists, would kind of go into that group or go into that movement in an attempt to find people who were sort of primed or ready to hear messages about exclusion and about kind of right-wing reactionary politics. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that Gamergate is something that shows us that, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, I like video games and I want to read a book about video games and it's fun, and it is fun and I love video games. But I also think we have this tendency, particularly in academia, to say oh, video games are just frivolous, maybe they're not really art, maybe they're just a province of juvenile adolescence. But it actually has become kind of an important cultural touchstone to a lot of people. And in fact, it's become a ground where the culture war is being contested. So you have conservatives who are arguing for preserving the the masculine core of gaming, and we don't want to let gaming become overly feminized or softened. And then you have people who are saying, let's make games more diverse. Let's use games to explore gender identity and to explore race and to explore disability and all these different kind of interesting intersections. So just like literature or just like film, it's become a space where people act out their identities and where people contest their identities.
Yeah, and I think a really important takeaway, not just from the beginning of your book, but the whole book, is that, and we're going to get into this a little bit later with your third chapter, but just this idea that people wanted to believe that we could all leave prejudice at the door when entering gaming culture, but you really find that it's actually not the case. We bring that directly into the gaming culture.
Right.
But before we get into that, I do want to, because you brought up the fact that the term gamer is very fraught, and I thought that it was an interesting work that you do sort of defining terms. So who are gamers, and why are gamers so invested in masculinity in this sort of online culture?
Okay, so who are gamers? I ask this question when I teach classes about digital culture. I'll say, how many of you students in this room kind of think of yourself as a gamer? And, you know, maybe maybe a quarter of the class will raise their hand. And, you know, that's actually kind of a lot. It's because I'm sure a lot of them signed up because they saw like digital culture in the name of the class. Or if I'm giving a talk somewhere, I'll ask, and then it'll just be like a smattering of people in the room, right? And then I'll say, okay, well, how many of you have ever played a digital game, like on your phone, on a console, on the computer? And it's everybody, right? Everybody has played Candy Crush or Words with Friends or Solitaire on their PC or whatever it might be. So that right there, I think, is the crux of where what is a gamer is being contested. Because so back when I was a kid in the 90s, video games were specifically something that were marketed to boys as a boy's toy. Video games kind of lived in the toy aisle. And, you know, if you go to the toy aisle in the store, you know, you have the pink one with the Barbies and the stuff for girls, and you have the boys' toys aisle with the action figures, and that's where the video games lived. And that's what the marketing campaigns said, was that video games are something that boys will enjoy. And so for a long time in video game culture, to be a gamer, like to have access to video games, was to be kind of interpolated into a certain kind of role as a consumer. Like, you're a boy, and you like to shoot things, and you like to play with technology. And it was sort of something that was baked into the sales pitch for these machines. And then as, you know, computers become more and more ubiquitous, and as smartphones become more and more ubiquitous, you start to get different kinds of people playing electronic games. Think about when the Nintendo Wii first came out, and they were marketing it as a game system for the family. And you would see commercials with like brothers and sisters playing together, or moms and dads playing a game with their kids. And a lot of folks who grew up in the 90s gaming culture, kind of being told that video games are a thing that you do with your bros, and it's something that's for boys, like it's a thing that boys can do. They can kind of retreat into the den and play this video game and kind of enact these, you know, boyish fantasies, G.I. Joe style fantasies. And so I think a lot of them felt a little bit betrayed by the idea that, you know, now we have these games and these systems that are being marketed to different kinds of people. And maybe that means that this hobby or this thing that we've kind of organized our identity around isn't exclusively masculine, or doesn't confer any kind of special, how do you want to say, any kind of like special energy. That sounds weird. That sounds like something Donald Trump would say in a tweet, right? Yeah. Like some dragon energy or something. Or who said that? Was that Kanye said that about Donald Trump? I don't know. But yeah, it was just this idea that folks who had grown up gaming had been told, you know, this is like a niche hobby. This is something that only like a particular kind of boy will enjoy, like a kind of nerdy boy who's into other nerdy things, science fiction, comics, stuff like that. And then as the hobby started to diffuse into the rest of culture, that identity of who gets to call themselves a gamer started to be questioned. And I think what we're seeing now is, you know, I always say, if you enjoy film, you're not like a movier, right? Like you don't build your identity around it. But in gaming culture, that participation in this particular hobby is sort of like a pillar around which people build their identity. And so when new kinds of people or new kinds of games enter into that arena, it's not just, oh, maybe someone else would enjoy this. It's, oh, you're presenting this to me, and now I don't know what to do with it because I've kind of built my understanding of myself around my interactions with this community and with this technology. And so what do I do with it? And I think the anxiety that gets caused by that kind of questioning is something that led to Gamergate being so popular. It was like, oh, I have this anxiety. I don't know how to feel about these new games that are coming out and about the fact that I can enter into a GameStop now and I see different kinds of people. And what does that say about me? And, you know, you take that anxiety in the same way that politicians have taken that kind of anxiety that's been floating around in the United States, and you mold it into action, I guess. And unfortunately, in the case of online culture, it was kind of a toxic set of actions.
Right. And part of what you argue in the book is that anxiety leads to this sort of like meta game of masculine policing. So like what is that, and how do they, those that engage in this metagame, how do they think that they would win?
Well, okay, so in the book, I posit that trolling is itself a game, that it's a game that revolves around how people do or do not demonstrate emotions. So trolling means saying provocative things, often things that are themselves gendered or sexualized, like calling people, I don't want to use the words that they use, I guess, but, you know, calling people gay in a negative way, or, you know, calling people, you know, saying that they're sissies or pussies or whatever. You know, if you're into gaming, you know that that's like the most mildest
right.
way to phrase it. But, you know, okay, so you can picture it, I'm sure. You don't need to hear it on this podcast. But the idea is you say these provocative things and you push against this person. And the game comes in where if you can get the other person to react with emotion, to say, you know, stop it, or you're hurting me, or even just with just anger, like screw you or whatever, then you've won that skirmish in the game, right? Like you've demonstrated that you could kind of bait the other person into losing self-control. And that in itself, you know, you would think that shouldn't be a gendered game, right? Because anyone can have emotions or can lose control of their emotions. But of course, you know, in our culture, being emotional is something that's read as feminine, and being kind of rational and calm and objective is something that's read as masculine. So in gaming culture, it doesn't matter who you are. You could be, you know, there are plenty of female trolls out there. There are plenty of men who succumb to trolling and react and have an emotional reaction. But the game is being played around who can kind of seize the position of the masculine objective person first. So it's kind of like King of the Hill, right? Like you're sort of racing to get to this position of authority, and you give up your authority when you have an emotional reaction. And so you can win an individual skirmish in that game, but the game never ends. It's you know, when you're playing King of the Hill, it's not like the first kid who gets to the top of the hill just wins and then everyone goes home. It's then you fight and you scrap and you claw that person down and pull yourself up to the top and then you get pulled down. It's like kind of a never-ending process, a never-ending struggle. And, you know, that's maybe where some of the anxiety comes in, is you're never safe. Like, you've never, okay, I've proven it now. I've proven that I'm rational and controlled and that I don't have emotional outbursts. And now I'm done and I'm in, right? Like, that never happens. You're always vulnerable to possibly being put in the sort of feminized, overly emotional position if you aren't careful and if you aren't vigilant. And so a lot of people, I think, in gaming culture will sort of preemptively adopt a trolling, toxic persona because they kind of, it's like, that's their armor, right? Is if I can kind of adopt that aloof, I don't care, you know, nothing matters, nihilistic persona when I'm online, then that's going to protect my position in this game and maybe prevent people from coming at me or seeing me as a target to be trolled or to be, harassed or whatever it might be. So it's, you know, it's like constantly having to reassert, you know, I have the right personality characteristics, I have the right persona to fit into this group, and you're never necessarily fully accepted into the group. You always have to continually keep proving yourself and keep proving yourself and even perhaps escalate your proving. So, you know, maybe one day I could just, within my group of friends, I could troll someone that I know and that would be enough. And then maybe the next day, now I have to troll a stranger that I meet online. And then maybe the next day, now I'm going to get on Twitter and I'm going to join this hashtag Gamergate and I'm going to publicly go after people. And it's like, you got to keep one-upping people and keep pushing and pushing in this game of trolling in order to feel secure in this community.
Right. And when you have your chapter on trolling and you're talking about trolling as this sort of like gender discursive act, right? You link to what is another one of my favorite books, C.J. Pascoe's ethnography of sort of high school masculinity, called Dude, You're a Fag. And you link sort of this discourse of trolling to, she finds sort of, she calls it fag talk and compulsive heterosexuality. And you sort of say that also maps onto this like gaming culture. So I wondered if you wanted to speak to that for a little bit, because I thought that was an interesting connection.
Yeah. So compulsory heterosexuality is like, you know, it's sort of similar. It's like you constantly have to brag about how many chicks you banged or whatever. Like, you can't just be straight and have that be accepted. You have to sort of continually find ways to assert your straightness. And one of the things I think is really interesting in that book is that they talk about how this is something that doesn't necessarily happen when women are present. It's something that happens between men when they're by themselves. So when you go online, I think there's this sense that you don't have access to people's bodies. And so that sort of compulsory, I need to constantly be performing as though I'm in a group of bros, it's kind of on all the time, because you can never be certain if you're surrounded by a bunch of guys and that this is supposed to be, you know, fag talk time where we bash on things that are perceived as queer so that we can assert that we aren't queer. Like, that could be all the time. And in fact, it used to be that more than likely if you were on the internet, you were surrounded by guys. Like, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, the internet was a very masculine place. And, you know, now, of course, the gender gap has closed and, you know, men and women are online in equal proportions. But I think when the sort of norms of etiquette of being online were first being formed, there was this idea that you're always kind of in a group of guys. And in some ways, maybe that's a little bit safe because you can talk about guy stuff. But in some ways, maybe it's less safe because it means that, you know, you have to perform this kind of particular kind of masculinity all the time. And there's no space for vulnerability, because if you're vulnerable and you're in one of these spaces, then maybe you're losing ground in your ability to project your own identity.
Yeah. And I think you sort of start the book off with going over trolling, and then your second chapter is about memes, right? As another sort of critical part of this gender discourse around gaming culture. So for those that aren't familiar with memes, what are memes? And then what memes are sort of most popular, most used in this discourse, and what are they doing?
Okay, so memes are... I'm gonna do two definitions, I guess. So the first definition would be like the official definition, and that is a meme is any little piece of information or culture that easily kind of spreads and transmits from person to person. So like that song that gets stuck in your head after you watch a commercial is a meme. Popular movie quotes that you exchange with your friends are memes, you know, any little cultural bit that kind of sticks in people's heads. And then online, a meme is a format that is easily repeatable, but also alterable. So think like, a image of a picture of, the dog who's sitting at the kitchen table and his house is on fire and he's got a little word bubble and it says everything is fine, right? Like, so, you know, odds are if you have been on social media, you've seen that a time or two, but it's also, so in that way it sticks in people's minds and it transmits and people share it, but also you can alter it. So you can change the words in a little word bubble if you're clever and you have Photoshop or whatever, and you can make it so that the dog is talking about something in particular, or you can make him say something different. So you're kind of riffing off of the existing sticky piece of culture that everyone has already seen and making it your own, while at the same time showing, I'm familiar with the stuff you're familiar with. I've seen this image that you've also seen. So it's kind of like an in-joke, right? Like when you're in a group and you all kind of reference the same things and know the same cultural touchstones. Memes are a way of kind of showing that you have that like in-group knowledge, because, you know, we're all circulating the same images around, but then you're also kind of putting your own spin on it and saying like, I'm also a unique individual because I can take this thing that we all share and I can put a little tweak on it to make it my own. So memes are really important in online culture because they often in addition to containing just references to popular texts, like this is a meme that has Zelda in it or whatever, or this is a meme about Mario. Like, so you can show that kind of in-group participation, but they can also kind of demonstrate the overall, I guess, like philosophy or ideology of a group. And you say like, what are the popular memes? That's really hard to say. And that's the thing that really sucks about writing a book about online culture is like the second that you've written things down, then you go online the next morning and now, oh, that meme's over. Now it's like this other meme. So, right. So I don't know if it's useful to say like, and the meme where it's idiot nerd girl, the girl who has nerd written on her hand, and the text will say something that's like really wrong about gaming culture, like to show that girls don't know anything about gaming. Like that was real. That's something I write about in the book because it was really big when I was writing, and you don't see it around as much anymore. Now there are different memes that are circulating, and there are different, you know, catchphrases. And it's interesting. The project I'm working on right now is looking at how some of these memes kind of jump communities. So one thing I think is really interesting is, so if you follow like alt-right politics, if you ever investigate like what's going on at Breitbart.com or whatever, I don't recommend it. It's not fun. But if you do, you'll know that one of the memes in that community is calling things they don't like, they'll say it's cucked. Like you are a cuck if you are a social justice warrior, if you're a progressive, if whatever. Like, you know, so that's a meme about failed masculinity and it circulates in that community. And I've started to see it cropping up in gaming spaces. So if you're in an online game and you get killed and you let your team down, then you might find yourself being called a cuck. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think that suddenly, you know, gaming culture independently kind of rediscovered this weird, like, what, you know, old-timey word for being, having a wife who commits adultery. Like, that connection, it can't just be coincidence. It means people, you know, are in these communities and they have overlapped. And something about that meme from the alt-right and from the quote-unquote manosphere or the anti-feminist circles, something about that meme kind of found purchase in this culture, and people in this culture identified with it. Like, oh, that's another word for an anxious masculinity that you would want to reject in order to show off that your own masculinity is sound. So it ended up kind of jumping the barrier between cultures and finding purchase in this new place. So yeah, I think memes are really interesting. They are kind of the way that you communicate online. And it's really hard for academics because we like to codify our arguments and kind of put them down and preserve them. But the thing that makes memes effective is that they're always shifting and you always have to keep up and you can't stop, in the same way that you're never allowed to just stop and be like, you know, I feel secure in my masculinity. I think I'm done proving myself. No, that's not allowed. So participating in meme culture means, you know, always having to scour the web for the new memes and knowing when a meme has become passé, and if you use it when it's out of fashion, then, oh, you've proven that you aren't invested enough in the meme culture. So now you've lost some ground in this game that we're participating in.
Yeah, and actually, as you say that, I've done research into how folks online, specifically on Reddit, use the word cuck. And you're right. And the biggest takeaway is that it's ever changing, the meaning that they're using it for within their community, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But within your discussion of memes, you do bring up this sort of, there are three, or were three, depending on, you know, when this is listened to, archetypes of sort of female gamers, right? Mm-hmm. And their sort of like memification. So like what were those archetypes and what purpose do they serve within this gendered discourse?
Yeah. Okay. So I argue in the book that as women started to become more visible in gaming culture, gamers needed to come up with a way to explain that reality that would preserve their worldview that gaming is for guys. And so, okay, well, how do we kind of jive our observations, like there's a girl in our GameStop, with our belief that games are things that guys are interested in? And so one way to do that is to split the gaming community in half and say, well, girls play electronic games, but they don't play real video games. Oftentimes this split is along the lines of casual versus hardcore. So like certain games, if they're casual or if they're accessible to people, like say The Sims or Candy Crush or something, then those become, well, those are video games and anyone can play those, but they're not like video games. They're not hardcore video games like a gamer would play. So that allows people to kind of say, well, I see women showing up and playing games, but I still can kind of believe in my secret heart that, you know, actual gamers are still all guys. That's one way that people deal with this. Another way that people deal with it is to say that the girls who show up in these gaming spaces aren't actually here because they're interested in games, but are here because they have a boyfriend or a dad or a brother or something who got them into it, and that they're there because they want to socialize. So they're like just kind of present in the background, and maybe they play a supportive role, like they cheer their boyfriend on while he is playing some first-person shooter. Or maybe they even play along, but they play a supportive character, a character who heals other characters or helps other characters, but isn't necessarily like directly in the action or driving the action. So, you know, in that version, it's like, well, girls are here, but they're here doing girly things, right? Like they're here to help. They're here to prop their partner up. And so that's okay. And then the third way that people deal with it is they say, well, maybe these women who are playing hardcore games and are driving the action and participating fully, not just acting as support characters, like that's the ultimate, oh no, this is really threatening our worldview now, right? So there's a meme that posits that maybe those girls actually aren't into video games, but they're just trying to trick unwary men into thinking that they're interested in video games so that they'll seem cool, so that maybe they can get something out of these guys. So that would be like people who stream video game play on Twitch, women who stream on Twitch, and people will say, oh, she just wants to get ad money and donations from guys. She's not really into video games. She's just like riding the bandwagon and trying to seem like a cool geek girl. Or sometimes you'll see, like, if a celebrity actress plays a gamer in a movie, people will say like, oh, she's just pandering to the gaming audience. Like, she doesn't really know anything about games. She's just trying to like capitalize on gaming's popularity. So, you know, those three explanations, like, they're obviously not necessarily contradictory, right? But like none of them are complete. But there's sort of three different tools people can reach for in order to deal with their cognitive dissonance when they see people entering into games, either as players or as developers or as critics, that they think, oh, like my worldview says that they don't belong here. These memes are sort of like common explanations that people can reach out and grab onto to reassure themselves and say, oh, actually, no, maybe it's fine. Maybe gaming itself, we can still kind of preserve it as a masculine pastime and we can explain these women who are here as aberrations according to one of these three categories.
Right. And before we explore sort of the later chapters of your book, I do want to take a break, pun intended, to talk about your game breaks in the in the book, because I thought this was a really unique way not only to write, but also to sort of insert gaming metaphors into your narrative about gaming, right? Mm-hmm. And so you take these various breaks and talk about either particular games or particular facets of games. So I wanted to know, like, what propelled you to sort of use that sort of writing style? And in particular, I wanted to talk about your game break about Far Cry 3, because I thought that was a really fascinating one.
Oh, okay, thank you. Well, the reason I decided to do it this way is because one of the things that I posit in the book is that when you play a lot of video games, you start to see non-gaming interactions through that lens. So like if you've ever been like moving and you're trying to pack all your stuff in a car trunk or something, and you start seeing it almost like Tetris, you're like, I can fit this in here, right? Like, so you get, you kind of get those gaming goggles, I guess. And as I was working on the book, I would also be playing games for fun, and I would start to see how some of these beliefs within gaming culture were showing up in video games, and not in like a really obvious call-out-y way. So it's not like a game character would like look down the barrel of the camera and be like, games are for guys. But it would be like in these... You know, it would be in these like kind of like understated ways where either the narrative of the game or the mechanics of the game, or what I find most interesting is when both those kind of work together to espouse like a particular worldview or encourage a particular way of looking, not just at games themselves as a hobby, but at kind of social systems of interaction. And so I think Far Cry 3 is a really interesting example, because the developers kind of explicitly said in interviews, you know, this game is supposed to be kind of a commentary on video games. So you've played lots of video games where you get dropped into a hostile environment and you have to find guns and fight your way out, right? Like that happens all the time. But that this game is supposed to be sort of like a meta commentary on that and a reflection on, you know, well, what does those types of games have to say about people of color, about women, about, you know, what happens to those kind of people who are on the periphery of that common game story? And I think Far Cry 3 really tried to interrogate that question, but in some ways it couldn't interrogate that question, because in order to successfully be a game where you land in a hostile environment, in this case an island, and have to fight your way off, in order to actually be that and to participate and be recognizable as that kind of game, it makes it very difficult to address what the people around you have to say or think. Like, in order to successfully be that kind of game, the genre has sort of foreclosed the possibility of doing that kind of meta commentary. And so I think it's an interesting attempt, but I also think it's a good case study in some of the ways that these genres and these game mechanics and these narratives that have proven popular in terms of like AAA blockbuster game releases, they've been sort of constructed specifically to foreclose that kind of self-reflection.
Right. And you kind of make the argument that when attempting that sort of satire or commentary, if the satire or commentary becomes indistinguishable from the actual thing it's commenting on, then it sort of becomes it becomes the thing it's trying to comment on.
Right.
And I think that bridges nicely into how you're linking this book to sort of alt-right politics as well.
Yeah, I mean, so that is something, you know, people will say, how do you tell the difference between an actual Nazi online versus someone who's just saying racist things and putting a swastika up as their profile picture to be edgy? Like, how do you tell the difference between those? Like, people who really mean it or people who are just doing it ironically? And I would say there isn't one, because intention doesn't necessarily matter, right? Like, we can look at the outcomes of both of those people existing in a space, and the outcome is going to be the same in both cases, that people of color are going to feel alienated in the space, that there's going to be kind of a silencing effect, that and also, I guess, you know, it's going to make it more likely that people who don't agree with white supremacist ideals are going to excuse themselves from the space, and the space will be kind of left only for the bigots and the people who are pretending to be bigots for fun. And I guess if you put it that way, like, the people who are pretending to be bigots for fun, that's when it becomes very clear, right? Like, oh, well, of course there's not a, like, why would you think it's fun to pretend to be a bigot unless you were actually, you're actually a bigot? Or maybe it doesn't matter what you actually are. you're out there running around, putting these beliefs out there into the world, whether or not you believe them in your heart of hearts, maybe doesn't matter as much as your actions. And we saw that with, like in Charlottesville. So you had the Unite the Right rally, and people were, you know, gathering with their tiki torches, and they're, you know, we have the KKK meeting up with neo-Nazis, meeting up with alt-right folks. And there were some cases of people kind of getting mixed up with the Antifa protests, who were protesting the Unite the Right groups. And when they were met with that resistance, when they were called out as, like, you know, how dare you march with these Nazis? Like, what's wrong with you? And they would be like, oh, well, I'm just here because I thought it would be funny. Like, I'm just here because I heard it was going to happen on Reddit, or I heard it was going to happen on 4chan, and I thought, like, oh, this is going to be hilarious. People are going to get so mad, and it's going to be great. And it's like, well, you brought yourself to a rally, and you marched. You physically, with your body, marched and held a sign or a torch and contributed to this rally. Like, okay, so what does that mean? Like, what does it mean to say, well, I'm here participating ironically, and no one would actually have known that unless you pulled me aside and talked to me? Because if you just watch a video of the rally, or if you just, you know, live in the city and watch the rally walk by, no one's gonna be able to tell the difference between you and the person next to you who actually is here because they are super into neo-Nazism and they want a white ethnostate. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think that that's really interesting, this idea that, like, you know, is it possible, or we have, how, this is how I want to say it. I think what these instances demonstrate is that you have to be really careful if you want to satirize some of these really intense, awful, racist and sexist beliefs, because it's really easy for your satire to become an instance of what it is that you're trying to satirize if you aren't really careful about how you mark yourself and how you mark the text, and how you want to make sure that as much as possible, you aren't accidentally just recreating that thing and then saying, well, but it's okay because I'm laughing at it. Well, okay, but unless the laughing at it is present in the text, you run the risk of just being one more racist or sexist thing out there in the world.
Right. And I think you do a good job at, like, attacking that assumption. Right. And another assumption that is made in gaming culture, but also you argue successfully, sort of permeates into our larger sort of political and social culture, is this idea that Certain things, and in this case, gaming, are apolitical, right? We're leaving our sort of identity and political beliefs at the door to enjoy this game or this culture. So you title the chapter No Homosexuals in Star Wars, mm-hmm. and you talk about sort of the message boards along the game, the Old Republic. So what happened in that message board, or the most famous post in that message board? And then what does it have to do with this discourse of being like apolitical, but also that stance being linked to sort of like privilege, right?
Yeah. Okay. First I want to say, who would have known, you know, so I wrote that chapter like 3 years ago. It was part of my dissertation. And, you know, now here we are with the Star Wars sequels, the new trilogy, and, you know, go online and nerds are real mad about new Star Wars because there's women and people of color in it. So, you know, that's weird. Like, you know, sometimes you accidentally run ahead of schedule and talk about something before, you know, and then you get lucky because when your book comes out, now people are talking about Star Wars a lot. But so in the chapter, what I'm talking about is there's this massively multiplayer online game called The Old Republic. It's like World of Warcraft, but set in Star Wars, basically. And the folks who make that game decided, you know, we want to ensure like the Star Wars brand is a family-friendly brand. We want to curb toxicity in our culture. And so they said, you know what, we're going to make it so that any use of terms like gay or lesbian or queer on our forums gets automatically censored. And the logic was, you know, hey, we have this fag talk that's going on all the time, this compulsory heterosexuality, and we don't want people calling each other names in our forums. And so we're just going to make it so that you can't use those words, which I think is an impulse that, like, I think their heart was in the right place, but it's an impulse that assumes that everyone who's in those forums and using words like gay or lesbian, like, must be straight dudes who are using it in an abusive way. And so some queer gamers popped up in the forums and said, hey, actually, you know, being gay isn't something bad that needs to be censored. And what if I want to come on to these forums and maybe I want to start a guild that's gay friendly, or maybe I want to role play a character in Star Wars who is a lesbian or whatever it might be. And so we object to the idea of just outright blanket automatically censoring these words, because that makes it seem like dirty or bad to identify as queer. And then this big fight broke out in the forums over this. So there were some folks who said, you know, we think that words like gay and lesbian and queer are overly political. You know, we came to Star Wars because we wanted to be a Jedi or a bounty hunter, not because we wanted to argue about gay marriage or whatever. And this is actually, so when this took place was kind of around the time that the Supreme Court was deciding about gay marriage. So like that was kind of on everybody's mind when they were talking about this in the forums. So there's this idea that like, okay, so if you want to talk about your queer identity or gay politics, you know, you can do that, but you shouldn't do that here in Star Wars world, because Star Wars world is supposed to just be fun and lighthearted. And we don't talk about politics in Star Wars world. And other folks said, you know, well, look at Star Wars. Star Wars is about politics. Star Wars is about what political system is being imposed upon the galaxy. It's about, you know, a resistance to an empire. So to say, you know, oh, well, we don't want to talk about gays and lesbians and queerness because that doesn't fit within this world, this apolitical world, is basically just cherry picking what you call politics, right? Like some things you call epic science fiction stories, like clashes between an empire and a resistance, and then some things you dismiss as politics. And what we need to do, I think, is recognize that, and, you know, if you're into gender women studies, say it with me, everything is political, right? Like, we can ruin everything. But, you know, but ruin isn't the right word, because, you know, a lot of these people said, you know, yeah, I do come to Star Wars because I want to pretend to be a Jedi. But if I'm a gay man, or if I'm a trans woman, or whatever I happen to be, then that's who I want to be as a Jedi or as a bounty hunter or whatever it is. And so to say, like, well, you can come play in our Star Wars sandbox, but make sure that you don't mention anything about who your partner is or who you love or, you know, all these different things. It's like, well, that does make my experience different and lesser than the experience of people who are straight, who can talk about my Jedi is in love with, you know, whoever, and they're going to get in-game married or whatever. Like, just that sort of overall pressure, the idea that, you know, certain ways of being are natural or normal, and then other ways of being are, you're just wanting to bring your politics into Star Wars. Like, that was sort of the crux of the debate. And what ended up happening was, the game company that runs the Old Republic ended up siding with queer folk and said, you know what, we want this game to be open and inclusive, and we think we stand to make more money if we broaden our audience and make our game welcoming to different kinds of people, then we stand to lose by having people who don't want to hear about queerness saying, we're going to quit this game, right? So it was sort of an interesting intersection between, like, queer politics and capitalism and, you know, a lucky confluence where people's right to expression kind of dovetailed nicely with this game company's desire to figure out what groups they should cater to in order to make money.
Yeah, and I think that in your last chapter, you sort of tie the discussion around gaming and online culture more explicitly to sort of contemporary politics. And we've been talking about that sort of throughout in our various discussions here. But you make this interesting point that I think folks may have heard before, but I think in the context of your book, it sort of garners a more a deeper meaning, right? But you call Donald Trump, like, our first troll president, right? Mm-hmm. And but not in the sense that we shouldn't take him seriously, but in the context that you've been talking about trolling. And I think that one of the really interesting connections here is going back to our discussion about satire and being able to not tell the difference, right? Mm-hmm. And then you become the thing. I think that, you know, he and sort of discourse around Donald Trump and his beliefs or non-beliefs, right, sort of fall into that category, right? That even if he may not believe these things, even if he may say them just to, you know, own the libs, quote,
yeah,
unquote.
Yeah. To trigger still, you.
Right. But because the difference is so indistinguishable at times, it's like, well, he is propagating those discourses,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, so, you know, just recently, you know, he was giving a speech and talking about how, like, you know, the West will not be erased, and, you know, we don't want to be replaced by immigrants and, like, all this rhetoric. And, you know, if you have explicitly, avowedly white supremacist people saying, he gets us, he heard us, he's saying our stuff, like, yeah, does it really matter if he's saying that stuff because he's a reality TV show host and he knows that controversy will get attention? Like, does it matter anymore if he means it or not? I would argue that, I don't know. I used to think, or maybe think is the wrong word. I used to hope that it was all just like an instinctual recognition of what works, right? Like an understanding that when I make the opposition mad, that generates more energy in my base than when I make my base themselves happy, right? So rather than positing proposals for what I want to do, I'm going to say things that make the other side just go, what? And then my side will be like excited about their madness. but you know, as time goes on, I don't know. I don't know what's in Donald Trump's heart. I think a lot of liberals wanted to believe that he was just like a huckster, and maybe he had some good handlers who were like helping him to tap into the anger of what, you know, whatever people always say, like, you know, blue collar middle America or whatever, like whatever. Like if you watch the news commentators right after the presidential election, everyone had their pet theory about like how this could have happened, right? But I don't know. I'm increasingly thinking, like, does it matter if Trump is the puppet of the alt-right or if he is like the actual mastermind of the alt-right? I don't think it matters. I think what matters is that we need to recognize that rhetorical tactic of trying to bait people into an emotional reaction, we need to recognize that that's effective and try to figure out ways that we can counter that tactic and not kind of play into the hands of, you know, pointing and saying, look at this awful offensive thing that this person said. Like to people on the left, we think like that's argument enough, right? Like be outraged with us at this horrificness. And what we need to learn is that, no, I think there's a lot of people who respond to not necessarily, well, I don't know. Maybe I'm letting people off the hook. I was going to say, maybe people are just responding to the fact that you owned the libs and that the content doesn't matter, but maybe that's letting people off the hook. Like, and maybe that's too hopeful to say, well, maybe America isn't really as racist as we think. Maybe they just are being ironically racist. That's the horrible thing, right? Is it's really easy to fall back into that debate of like, do they mean it? Do they not mean it? Are they redeemable? Are they deplorable? I don't know. I think maybe we just need to step out of that debate and instead start trying to figure out, okay, well, what is an effective rhetorical set of memes or position that we can take that will counter that, as opposed to just being upset that works. We need to figure out what works on our side.
Yeah. And for folks that, you know, maybe don't consider themselves gamers or into gaming culture, I think that parallel is a really sort of accessible way to understand trolling culture online, right? Because of those parallels that exist there. I know I've taken up a lot of your time today, and I want to thank you again for joining the podcast. But I was wondering if, you know, if you had readers pick up your book and you want them to have one takeaway that they take with them, what would that be?
Oh, no, that's the hardest question. if I wanted them to have one takeaway, I guess I would say what I want people to take away is that games are worth taking seriously. Even if you, like, you know, well, one, like, I was going to say, you said if people aren't familiar with gaming culture, then this description is maybe accessible. Like, I'm not going to say like everyone should make games their hobby now. Like, if you enjoy games, great. If you don't like them and they're too loud and obnoxious, then great. Like, I'm not saying in order to be a participant in culture, you must be a gamer. But I am saying that games are worth taking seriously because they are important to some people, and because maybe some people's politics is being formed by their participation in games culture in the same way that, you know, I don't know, all media, whenever it comes to the fore, ends up shaping people's politics in some way, shape, or form, right? Like, so in academia, when film studies first came around, people were like, movies are just for eating popcorn and entertaining the children, like they're not important. But then we realize, oh, they actually are important and they can convey these political and ideological messages. The same with television and same with whatever. And I think what I want people to take from the book is, like, games are worthy of that consideration too. And I focus on gender in games, but I would love to read, like, a Marxist critique of games. I would love to read, Keshana Gray is a friend of mine, and she's working on a project on race, and in particular what it's like to be a Black woman I think she's finished with that book already, the book about what it's like to be a Black queer woman on Xbox Live. If you're a gamer, you know, you just shuddered when I said that. Right? Like you can already hear the chat. but like, you know, I want to read from more people about the intersections between gaming and all these different identity categories. And I want to read more about this new form of communication, this new form of art. And I hope that I contributed a little bit to that conversation. Question mark? I don't know.
Well, I would argue you did. And, apart from your friend's recent work, which sounds very fascinating, if folks pick up your book, and I'm sure they will love it, and they want to read more about, you know, this sort of subfield within gender studies, are there any books that you would recommend to those listeners?
Yeah, I'm going to plug my friend's actual title of her book, because I want to give her the full credit. So her name's Keshana Gray. And she wrote Race, Gender, and Deviance in Xbox Live, Theoretical Perspectives from the Virtual Margins. So she's great. I would also recommend Adrian Shaw's Gaming at the Edge, which is also about sexuality and gender and, in some ways about representation in games. So I would say my book is more about the people who are playing games and the interactions that they have online and in forums. And her book is more about, let's look at how women or queer people are, like, as characters in game stories are being represented. So those two, I think, are really great. And then, I don't know, I think this is maybe cheating as a response to your question, but I would say if you can, maybe just ask friends who play games, like, what games they might recommend to you. So, you know, just try to dip your toes into the waters. And if you have gamer friends, they'll tell you which ones to avoid because they're, like, the more toxic corners of gaming culture. But they might be able to recommend something you can play on your phone or something that you can play in your web browser that could be interesting to you. And one of the things we didn't talk about really is that there are independent game makers who are creating spaces and stories for people other than straight white guys. And they just maybe aren't in the AAA scene yet, but they're out there in the indie scene. So, you know, even if you don't think of yourself as a capital G gamer, I would say maybe go out there and see if there is anything that you would like.
Yeah, and I will say on that point, someone out there who needs a dissertation idea needs to do sort of some sort of spatial analysis of E3, the big gaming conference, because I was there this most current iteration of the conference, and those indie games that you're talking about that are more inclusive and might be trying to market themselves to a further market than just straight white guys were sort of in these corners of the a conference hall, right, and sort of away from the main stage. So that would be an interesting analysis.
So like literally we have the center and the margins.
Exactly.
That's really
exactly. But I have taken up enough of your time today. I encourage all of you to check out Dr. Condis's book, Gaming Masculinity, Trolls, Fake Geeks, and the Gendered Battle for Online Culture. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I had a blast.